my pleasure to welcome you to the Fall 2019 Eminent Scholar Lecture of the Hegler Institute for Advanced Study. My name is Clifford Fry. I'm Associate Director of the Hegler Institute, and Dr. John Junkins, sends his welcomes and his regrets that he cannot be here tonight. He was called to a meeting in Colorado that he could not get out of, but he is honored to have this lecture and for you to attend. The finest universities in the world have access to the finest minds in the world, and the Hegler Institute is devoted to bringing the finest minds into Texas A&M, and the Hegler Institute's a permanent part of Texas A&M University now, and we brought in 70 what we call faculty fellows to work with our faculty and students for up to 12 months. So they come in for extensive stays. On average, they come in for about 6 months. And some come in over multiple years. And today we are pleased to have Dr. Vincent Poor, who is a 2018-2019 faculty fellow of the Hegler Institute. And I have asked one of Texas A&M's very distinguished professors to introduce Dr. Poor, tell you about him. But Thomas Overby is an eminent professor of the Texas Engineering Extension Service. He's director of the Smart Grid Center at Texas A&M, and he's a member of the National Academy of Engineering. And Dr. Overby, please.
And I don't think we're going to get a finer faculty mind than Vince Poor to come be with us and talk with us this evening. Vince is the Michael Henry Strader University Professor of Electrical Engineering at Princeton University from 77 until 1990. He was on the faculty of University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We actually just missed each other because I joined there in 91, but I heard lots of good things about you, so you had quite a reputation. After he left there, he went to Princeton. At that time, he was from 2006 to 2016. He served as a dean of Princeton School of Engineering and Applied Science. He's also held a number of visiting appointments at many other institutions. I guess you did a good job of being dean because they've got you back as the interim dean, right? And that just started and go until you get somebody to fill. Yeah, no good deed goes unpunished. Vince is a member of the National Academy of Engineering. He's in Section 7, which is Electronic Communication and Information Systems. He got elected to the NAE in 2001. When you get elected to the NAE, they spend a lot of time trying to figure out the right citation to summarize your career in 20 words or less, and I'll read what they said for Vince in 2001. His election citation was for contributions to signal detection and estimation and their applications in digital communication and signal processing. Vince has been very involved in the NAE with lots of different activities, and he's currently on the top committee, which is the Council of the NAE. About 10 years back, he got into the power systems area, and we're delighted to have him helping us out in the power systems area, and we're delighted that you can talk to us tonight about the smart grid, the Internet of Energy. So, Vince.
Thank you, Tom, for that really nice introduction. Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming tonight. It's a real honor for me to be here. I really appreciate the invitation to speak and the opportunity to talk here tonight. I'm a little intimidated talking about the electricity grid at Texas A&M. This is one of the preeminent institutions in power systems. And so talking about the grid here is a little bit like bringing coals to Newcastle. But I hope I can say a few things that will be fresh to the audience here. I want to start out by saying a little bit about why I'm going to be talking about the electricity grid. So when you heard the citation that Tom read when I was elected to the National Academy of Engineering, you didn't hear anything about electricity grids, and I spent most of my career working in wireless networks. So why am I here talking about the grid? Well, so first of all, let me say a little bit about how I view smart grids. A smart grid is a term that's applied to an emerging generation of electricity grids that overlay the more traditional electromechanical grid of generators, loads, relays, and so forth, overlay that with a cyber layer of communication networks, sensors, controls, and so forth and so on. And I'll say a little bit more about motivating that later. But basically, the idea is that you have a cyber layer laying over a physical system. So it's a type of so-called cyber physical system. And communication networks, or at least wireless networks, have some similar characteristics. In particular, there's a physical layer. It's, in the case of wireless networks, it's the layer of the ether where wireless communication takes place. There are receivers, transmitters, and so forth, all these physical objects. And then on top of that, there's a cyber layer of the network and so forth. And so there's some similarities conceptually between the smart grid and wireless networks, which I've been working on basically since the early 1980s. So as Tom said, I got interested in this about 10 years ago. A lot of people in my field have taken an interest in the smart grid, and so that's really where I'm coming from today. I'm an electrical engineer. When I was an undergraduate, I studied power systems like all electrical engineers do. It was a long time ago. So I'm not really an expert in that physical part of the power grid, and certainly here in this audience there are many, many distinguished experts. But I did, when I was preparing this talk, I did call on two of my colleagues who are experts, and I just want to call their names here. One is Minji Chen, who's one of my colleagues at Princeton. He's an expert in power electronics, which is one of the innovations that's being enabling the smart grid. And he helped me some with these my presentation. He helped me understand some things, some of the physical things. And also Sally Sultan, who was a postdoc in my group at Princeton for several years and now is at Amazon, who's also another power engineer. So some of the things I'm going to say come from the tutelage I got from these two colleagues. So this is the way my talk's going to go today. So first of all, I'll give a little background on the smart grid, or on the power grid in general. And then I'll talk about smart grid. I'll motivate it a bit. Then I'll talk about some of the solutions and challenges that it brings. And then I'll wrap up. And I think we'll have time for questions then. So let me get started with some background. So first of all, the power grid is one of the most important infrastructures to society. So many other infrastructures rely on it. But in some ways, it's a little bit invisible to the public. As long as the lights are on, people don't really think about the grid very much. So it's kind of an underappreciated infrastructure, at least by the general public. But engineers really love the power grid. And the National Academy that Tom mentioned at the end of the 20th century looked back at what are the most important or the greatest engineering achievements of the 20th century. And number one is electrification. Okay, well, now we take it for granted, but if you go back 100 years ago, certainly at the turn of the 20th century, certainly electrification was not taken for granted. And engineers think it's the number one thing of the 20th century, and many of the other top 20 things are things that rely completely on the electricity grid. If we didn't have the electricity grid, many things that we take for granted in society just would not be here. And certainly many of the other things, like hospitals, other things like that, rely so much on electrification that it's hard to imagine them today without that. So the power grid is extremely important to us, as invisible as it may seem at times. Also, the electricity, the production of electricity uses a lot of the energy that's consumed in this country. I think you can probably see this okay back there. This is put together every year by Lawrence Livermore Labs. You can see this online. This is from last year, but it just shows the sources of energy in the U.S. and then where they go. So here you see petroleum, coal, natural gas, and so forth. And electricity here is almost 40% of the use of electricity generation is almost 40% of the use of energy in this country. Transportation being the other big one, and then manufacturing being another big one. But electricity is, generation is a big consumer of energy in this country. And an interesting thing about this chart is that you can see here, there's the orange. So this is electricity generation here, 38.2%. You can see that some of it actually goes to use, us, and commercial and industrial and so forth, but a whole lot of it is rejected as heat, okay? This is, part of it is in generation because generators put out, steam power generators put out a lot of heat, and a lot of it is just waste heat, and there are other inefficiencies as well. So one of the things about the smart grid is to try to reduce that part of the energy that's used to generate electricity that in fact turns out to be wasted as heat. So anyway, that's sort of another reason to care about the grid. The lights are on, fine, but also it uses a lot of energy. So a lot of the oil that's pumped out in Texas and wherever places, coal that's dug up in West Virginia, natural gas from Pennsylvania, a lot of that goes to making electricity. Also, another way to think about the electricity grid, and this is the transmission grid. I'll get into the different parts of the grid in a second. But the generation and transmission grid, which the transmission grid is the part of those big pylons you see marching across the countryside, thus the transmission lines, it's the largest running machine in the world. So we might think of the electricity grid as being an electrical thing, but actually it's really mainly a mechanical thing. You have these big generators generating electricity. It's all connected, at least piecewise connected, and it's a huge machine that's running together synchronously, essentially. Okay, so it's a really amazing engineering achievement. You can see why engineers like it so much. It's actually divided up into the U.S. transmission grid is divided up into three pieces. One is the eastern connection, one is the western connection, and the other one is Texas. So Texas has its own. You know, it's a special place. It has its own connection. There are also two other independent connections in Canada. Okay. Anyway, it's a big machine. You can see this 9,200 generating units, 1 million megawatts of capacity, 300,000 miles of transmission lines, and here it says 99.97% reliable. Okay, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Okay, so let's go back and think about where the grid came from. So first of all, if you go back before the electric grid, before electrification, light and heat, so forth, all these things came from fire. Okay, so if you wanted light, you had to light, you had to burn something. Okay, so we lived in a world that was lit by fire. Okay, and in the 19th century, there were a group of scientists who started studying the properties of electricity and electrical circuits. And here are some of the key ones. George Ohm, a German, who studied the relationship between voltages and currents in conductors, so-called Ohm's law. Faraday, a Britishman, who studied induction together with Henry, who was an American, a Princeton professor back in the 19th century. There's Faraday's law, some of us like to call it Henry's law. Anyway, he studied the properties of induction, that is, when you move a magnet around a conductor, it induces a current in the conductor. So that's the key principle behind motors and behind generators and motors, basically. And then there's Maxwell, who studied the propagation of waves, another Britishman. Of course, transmission lines involve basically the propagation of electric waves down the transmission lines. And then finally, Kirchhoff, another German, who studied circuits, basically, the laws of circuits, which govern how electricity flows in the grid. Okay, so this is a lot of scientists were laying down the sort of physical properties of electricity back in the 19th century up until about the mid-19th century. So like many things, once the fundamentals were laid down, entrepreneurs came along and tried to figure out how to turn this into something that we could use. And these are some of the principal entrepreneurs here. Edison, Thomas Edison, their name is synonymous with invention. And George Westinghouse, okay, another important entrepreneur in this field. And this guy is This guy is Nikola Tesla, who was another engineer, who also did a lot of fundamental work in electricity. So there was a big war, they call it War of the Currents, back in the late 19th century. So, you know, Thomas Edison developed the light bulb, and he quickly realized that if he was going to sell light bulbs, he had to provide electric current to people to light the light bulbs. Okay, so he built something called Pearl Street Station in Lower Manhattan, which was a so-called direct current, or DC, generating station that could light up the neighborhood around it. Okay, and around the same time, there was discussion that maybe direct current wasn't the best way to transmit electricity over distance, but rather we should use alternating current. So direct current, the electrons flow in one direction. Alternating current, they flow back and forth. And alternating current is what we're using here, probably, unless these are LED lights. And in any case, there was a big controversy, sort of a discussion, or what do you have, a scientific controversy between Edison and Tesla and Westinghouse on the other hand, as to whether it was better to use direct current or alternating current. Now, a problem with direct current in those days was that one of the properties of electricity, and this goes to Ohm's work, is that basically the amount of energy expended in a conductor is quadratic, that is square, of the current flowing through there, okay? And power is the product of voltage and current. So the voltage time current gives you power. So if you want to transmit over long distances, you'd like to have the voltage high and the current low, okay? But it was very hard at that time to have very high voltage DC. On the other hand, with AC, the principle of induction goes back to Henry and Faraday, allowed the development of transformers, which would allow you to take low voltage AC, you could generate at low voltage, and you could step up the voltage using a transformer, which is what we do now, okay? And so that was an important innovation that allowed transmission over very long distances. So Westinghouse built a plant at Niagara Falls, an AC plant, and it could transmit electricity reliably for maybe 100 miles. Okay, or 200 miles, whereas the DC plant that Edison built in Pearl Street could really only transmit maybe over a mile or so before the losses got to it. So AC won out, and that's the kind of transmission lines we have today, although DC is making a comeback, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. There's a movie, by the way, I don't know if anybody's seen it. It's called Current Wars. It features Benedict Cumberbatch as Thomas Edison. I don't know, this is Michael Shannon, I guess, he's Westinghouse. It just came out, it was released not long ago. It was actually made in 2017, but it got caught up in the Harvey Weinstein thing, and it was off on the shelf for a while, but now it finally, somebody else bought it and has released it, so it's out. There's also a movie, by the way, a biopic about Tesla, with Ethan Hawke in the role of Tesla. I don't think that's come out yet, but I think it's been produced. So anyway, if you want to know more about this, the drama of this, you can go see this movie, The Current War. In any case, so AC won out, and you can see from that day, so that's sort of late 19th century when this was happening, and then from that time till now, electricity use in the U.S. has just grown up enormously, okay? This is, the units here are billions of kilowatt hours, okay? So a lot of power being generated. And you can see, this only plots it up to 2015, and one thing I'll note is that it's starting to level off, okay? So electricity consumption in this country is starting to level off, partly because of smart grid types of things, okay? We'll see later what that's about. Okay, so how is the grid made up? Well, there are basically four main things in the grid. There are, first of all, generators. We all know what those are. These are these big power plants, mostly. Then I already mentioned the transmission network. This is the high voltage wires that you see going marching across the countryside. And then when the electricity gets to us, it's stepped down in voltage in the distribution network. So the voltages here you see are hundreds of kilovolts, okay? Whereas the voltage is down the distribution network, and when it gets all the way down to our house, it's only 110 volts or maybe 220, right? So It's being transmitted at high voltage just to keep the current low so that the losses in the transmission lines will be low. Okay, but we don't want 765 kilovolts in our house, so it's stepped down to something that's safer. Okay, and then we're the loads. This is us. So this is where human beings interact with the network or the load. So these lights are loads, for example. Now, this model is being disrupted. So this is a classical model of the power grid. And what I'm going to talk about most of the rest of the time are sort of disruptions to this model. Okay. All right, so let me say a little about this. So this is a little bit of an oversimplification, but I think we could say the following. So, you know, if Alexander Graham Bell, who's the inventor of the telephone, a contemporary of Edison, if he came back to life today, he wouldn't recognize the telephone network. He wouldn't know what this was, right? He would have no idea what this was, right? And so modern telephony is just completely transformed from what it was in its early days. On the other hand, if Thomas Edison came back, he might recognize a lot of the power grid. It's much more similar to what it was in those days than, say, telephones are to what they were in those days. Okay, so and one of the things, like in my field, and I mentioned I work in wireless networks, I think people probably have heard the term 5G, right? So what does 5G mean? Well, there was, in the 1980s, there was 1G, and here we are, I don't know, 35 years later, and we've already been through four more generations of complete new innovations in wireless telephony, okay? So that's from 1985, and here we're talking about a technology that's really from the late 19th century. It hasn't been through nearly that many generations of innovation. It's really now that a lot of innovation is being developed. Not that there haven't been other innovations, but certainly with the smart grid and with the introduction of the cyber infrastructure, it's starting to become much more innovative in the way that telephony has been in recent years. Now, there are reasons for this. One of the reasons is that the electricity grid is very heavily regulated. I think everybody knows that. Every state has its own commission for power and other utilities. It's very heavily regulated. It has huge capital expenditures. To build one of those power plants is billions and billions of dollars. So there's a completely different economic model for the power grid than there is for, say, cellular telephone network. So there are reasons why it's been more conservative than telephony, but also now we have opportunities to change that. That's really what smart grid is about. So let me say a bit about that. So first of all, what is the smart grid? Now, been talking about it here. Well, this again is a bit of an oversimplification, but let's just think about a traditional grid, which is already being transformed, but this is a way to think about it. As I said at the beginning, it's an electromechanical system, so it's mainly generators, loads, relays, and so forth. The generation is centralized, so you have big power plants. That's where the electricity comes from. And there are a few sensors. There's a sensor system called the SCADA system, traditionally, but it's not as rich in sensors as smart grid. A lot of what happens in terms of monitoring the grid is done by human beings. It's manual. There's a lot of failures and blackouts often. I don't know if there are here, but where I live in New Jersey, power goes out all the time. And customers, at least in the traditional grid, really don't have much to say about how things are working. It's very centralized. Power is generated. It's distributed out to the loads. Okay. And smart grid, on the other hand, it's a cyber-physical system, as I said. In addition to the electromechanical grid, there's a cyber layer on the top. The generation is distributed, so you have renewables, okay? People have solar arrays on their houses, there are wind farms out there. Sensing is much more advanced. I'm going to say more about all these things later. The power electronics, a lot of experts here in the audience in power electronics. There's enormous innovation in that field in recent years, a lot of things. I'll say more about that in a minute, too. The idea is that it'll be self-monitoring and self-healing. That is, if you have enough sensors, you can tell the computers can tell what's going on in the grid and automatically do things to overcome potential outages and so forth. It makes it more adaptive and reliable, and then also customers can have more say in how their energy is used. I'm going to say more about all these things as we go ahead. So why do we care about this? Well, first of all, we'd like to make it more efficient, make the existing generation more efficient. So one issue with the grid is that you have to, there's peak load, right? You have to have enough generation to handle peak load. And if you could shift some of that peak load into off-peak times, like at night, you need less generating capacity, right? So that's one of the things you might do if you have enough intelligence in the grid, is to shift load from peak times into off-peak times. Also, the idea, another important aspect is, of course, the to facilitate the deployment of renewables, okay? And I'll say a bit more about why that's a challenge in a minute. Enabling resilience, I mentioned that already, trying to automate a lot of what happens in the grid rather than having humans having to intervene. Sometimes the grid might be able to take care of itself. Introduction of, one of the things is smooth transition to electrical vehicles and other kinds of storage mechanisms. Okay, so that's another innovation that's happening now. Demand side management, I'm gonna say more about this as well. This is allowing the consumer to have some say into what he or she, how he or she uses electricity. And then just in general, you know, the subtitle of my talk was sort of the Internet of Energy. And sort of the idea here is just to have a platform out there where new products, services, and markets can develop, just like when the Internet came in. It was a platform where that kind of thing happened. Here's an opportunity for doing that kind of thing as well. But the basic bottom line is that the smart grid is here, coming to give us greater efficiency, reliability, and security. And I'll talk more about those things now. Okay, so one of the important issues is efficiency. One of the statistics I pulled off the web here is this one. It says that the U.S. accounts for 4% of the world's population while contributing 25% of its greenhouse gases. Okay, so we disproportionately produce greenhouse gases in this country. And if we were able to make the grid just 5% more efficient, that would be equivalent in terms of generation of greenhouse gas emissions and using fuel to 53 million cars, okay? So the grid is huge, it uses so much energy. Just 5% less would be like taking 53 million cars off the road in terms of energy use, okay? Also, reliability is very important. This is a picture, you guys live in Texas, but if you live in the Northeast, you remember that in 2003, there was a huge blackout. Started in Ohio, I forget what it started, maybe a squirrel got into a transformer or something, yeah. Tree branches came down, okay, thank you. And it started a so-called cascading failure that swept all the way into the East Coast and brought down the East Coast grid, part of the grid. This black part here, this is from space, this black part here is basically where I live. So part of the problem here was that there were the response times were slow. So they have something called islanding, where if you can detect outage, you can sort of wall it off so that it doesn't cascade into the rest of the grid. And unfortunately, it was slow to happen because everything was mechanical, human decisions were being made. There weren't really automated systems that could detect and quickly island off that where that happened. So if they had then, maybe they could have avoided this kind of an outage. So that's another issue that smart grid is addressing. Another issue is security. Okay, and you may have read about this. Here's a headline about it. But you know, if increasingly, in fact, this is actually something that smart grid could potentially make worse. We all know that people can hack the internet, right? So if you put the electricity grid on the internet, then you've got the potential of hackers. But increasingly, power plants and all sorts of aspects of the grid depend on computers, and these computers are networked, and hackers can get in there and control those things. So there's a big issue with that. So just like any cyber infrastructure, security is a huge issue for a smart grid. Okay, so those are some of the issues. Let me now talk about some of the solutions and some of the challenges that come out of those issues. Okay. So first of all, I mentioned the issue of efficiency. And, of course, one of the big trends in recent times has been integration of renewables into the grid. And this chart shows, I think you can see this okay from the back, this is like the new generating capacity that's being brought online versus time, okay, over the last, I guess, 30 years, essentially, okay? And you can see that certainly if you go back to the early 2000s, there was a huge investment in gas-powered generation. And that's because of the gas that was discovered out in West Pennsylvania. And, of course, natural gas is very cheap now relative to other forms of energy. And so there's a lot of natural gas power generating power these days. But about 2006, you can see that the investment in renewables, so blue here is renewable, I should say this. So gray is natural gas, black is coal. There's not many coal plants being built anymore. Nuclear is red, so there's some nuclear plants being built or planned. But what the big story here in recent years is renewables, okay, generating capacity based on renewable sources of energy, okay? And you can see that this is gigawatts, okay? So billions of watts, okay? These are big, big generators. And this says a little bit about, I guess, how much of our electricity is. So this one I just showed. This is generating capacity that's being added. This shows where our power is coming from now. Okay, this goes up to 2017, but you can see here some trends. So first of all, natural gas, as I said, has grown. That's the gray. Nuclear has held steady pretty much. Coal has declined. And renewables are sort of taking up the slack, okay? And the amount of energy is, as I said, is starting to decrease, mainly because of efficiencies, okay? But here you can see that renewables are starting to be an important part of our portfolio of power generation. This is an interesting chart. It shows the sort of how much carbon dioxide or how many equivalent cars have been replaced by wind power versus time. And you can see here, this also goes up to 2017, you can see here like 40 million cars basically already have been displaced, or at least the amount of energy that would be used by driving 40 million cars have already been replaced by wind energy. A lot of that, by the way, is here in Texas. It's a big producer of wind energy. And carbon dioxide, you can see here also, 189 million metric tons, that's a lot. And even if you don't care about carbon dioxide, it also reduces other pollutants, sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide, which are health risks. And I found this, an article that said these are now, in 2018, the reduction of these pollutants has created $9 billion in public health savings in 2018 alone. Okay, so even if you don't worry about carbon dioxide, you should be worrying about sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide, which are health hazards. And burning of some fossil fuels can cause that, and can release those if they're not scrubbed properly. And so this use of wind generation is displacing that kind of pollution. Another aspect of these big power plants is they use water. So you see the cooling towers. Well, that's the cooling down. I mentioned all the heat that's generated. And so this shows the amount of water that's been saved by that wind energy. You see this? So it's 95 billion gallons. This is in 2017, I guess. So this is equivalent to 723 billion bottles of water, okay, that's not being used because of the use of wind power over to generate the same amount of electricity using other means. Okay, so, this is really a big win for the environment, for our health, and so forth. Water, of course, is a very important natural resource and one that's becoming more and more important in society, more and more scarce, I guess is a word I should say. Solar is another big part of renewables. And what's shown here is solar installations versus time. Again, now coming up estimated for 2019. But basically, I think the story here, I think people are probably not going to be surprised by this chart. There are two stories here. One is, what is this ITC? It's a tax credit. Okay, so solar has been driven, a lot of solar has been driven by tax credits. Still not as cheap as, say, natural gas or something else per kilowatt. But you can see there's quite a bit of investment in solar. And I think the other interesting story here is that what the colors are mean. So you might think it's mostly on people's rooftops, and that's what this blue, dark blue is here. This is residential solar. But it really, the interesting story to me is this light blue, which is photovoltaic or solar energy generated by utilities. Okay, so utilities are using a lot of solar as well. A lot of that, so a lot of wind is here in Texas, a lot of solar is out in California. And here's a picture of that. So this is really the plan. So this is the current state of the art. Let me back up in solar, and I showed the current state of the art in wind. This is sort of what's being planned now for the next 5 years. And let me see if I can interpret this for you. So dark blue here is wind generation. Light blue is solar generation. There's oil and gas. This is mostly gas. There's some coal, not much, and other renewables, which could be biomass and things like that, or even hydro, although there's not much hydro being developed right now. But you can see here that Texas is the largest producer of wind power in the U.S., and there's a lot more being planned. Okay, in fact, you can see most of the wind is up here to the east of the Rockies, where the wind blows a lot. I used to live in Illinois. The wind blows a lot there. Tom used to live there, too. And out here on the coast, so on the east coast, it's mostly going to be offshore. And then a lot of solar is being developed out here where the sun shines all the time, California, and so forth. But this is what's happening in terms of future generation. At some nuclear, we talked about that just before. Not much. Five plants, I think you said, have been approved. What are some problems? Well, one of the challenges with renewables is that they're volatile. Okay, if you crank up a power plant, it's going to run as long as you're putting fuel in, right? But if you have a solar array or a wind farm, the solar array is only going to generate electricity when the sun's shining, and the wind farm is only going to generate electricity when the wind's blowing. And those are natural phenomena that are volatile, okay? So there's that's a problem with the grid for multiple reasons. One is it just means that the power is not always available. But also, the way the grid is controlled has to do with is to control the frequency. So the power is at 60 cycles per second or 60 hertz. That's the frequency of the electricity wave in your house. And the way the grid is controlled is that the load and generation are being constantly balanced to keep that at 60 cycles. And if it falls too far either way, you start having problems. Generators start tripping and things like that. So it's very important to keep those two in balance. And if you have sudden changes, volatile sources like wind and solar, this can be a big challenge. It's not a challenge if you only have a small penetration of renewables, but once you get large penetrations of renewables, 50%, 60%, this gets to be a serious issue, okay? And that part of that issue is so-called lack of inertia. So when you have a power plant going, it's a big mechanical thing spinning. It has a lot of inertia, okay? It keeps going. If the wind stops blowing, boom, the power goes off. No inertia. If the sun stops shining, boom, the power goes off. No inertia. There's nothing to keep the things going, okay? So inertia is very important to keep if you want to control something, you'd like for it to change smoothly with a lot of inertia, okay? And when you have a lot of renewables, you start losing inertia, okay? So that's one of the big issues as well. Another challenge is that with renewables, particularly with residential renewables, is that in the old system, power was generated centrally and distributed out, and all the power flow was in one direction, right? But now, with generation distributed, power starts flowing in both directions, okay? So when you have distributed generation, you can get reverse power flows and things like that, and that also can cause problems with grid stability and control and so forth. So that's another issue that has to be mitigated for as more and more renewables come online, or not even renewables, but other kinds of distributed generation, like smaller gas-fired plants and so forth. So this is an issue. Now, a solution is storage, okay? If we could, one of the problems with electricity is it's generated and it's used immediately, right? I mean, it's not, there's no place to put it, okay? Now, you can put a little bit in a battery, and increasingly, you can put more and more in batteries, but there's just no way to do large-scale storage, okay? I mean, there are some ways of doing large-scale storage. For example, build dams. That's what hydroelectric dams do. But it's very hard to have the kind of storage that would mitigate the lack of inertia if a lot of the energy is being generated by renewables. But there's a lot of research in this area. There's a big area in trying to find ways to store energy. And increasingly, there are more and more solutions, okay? I'll just mention pumped hydro, which is the idea is that at night when you have plenty of power and you don't have many customers, you pump water uphill, and in the daytime you let it roll back down and generate electricity. So that's one way you store, mechanically store the electricity up on the top of a mountain. There are also ideas using capacitors, which are, I think people know what a capacitors are. They're a type of electrical device. If you have a really, really big one, you can store a lot of energy on it. That's basically it stores voltage and so forth. So there are and the use of electric vehicles. If we all had electric vehicle in our house, that means we all have a battery in our garage. We could store energy there. Okay, so we don't have nearly the penetration of electric vehicles now to make that big time, but maybe at some point that could be the case. And there are a lot of other technologies being developed as well. But this would be huge. If we could have massive storage, we could mitigate a lot of the issues that I mentioned already, particularly with stability and so forth. So another solution, this is a solution to the improved reliability of the grid, is advanced measurement and control. Okay, so the basic idea here is that if we have, so now there's a system called the SCADA system. It's being enhanced now with other kinds of sensors, but it basically is a fairly low data rate system for seeing what's happening in the transmission grid. But in recent years, there's been the development of new types of sensors that are being deployed in much greater numbers, giving us much more refined idea of what's happening in the grid and allowing much finer control of what's going on in the grid. Okay, so this is an important advance as well. There's some people here in the audience who work in this area. And one of the types of sensors that's been developed is the so-called phasor measurement unit. The phasor is just a word for looking at a voltage, looking at its magnitude, that is, how many volts is it, and looking at the so-called phase angle. So the phase angle just says a little bit about the timing of the electric signal. And knowing that allows you to do much finer control than sort of more traditional SCADA systems, okay? And this chart just shows the deployment of PMUs in the U.S. You can see there's some in Texas. And there are more and more of these being deployed all the time. There's a lot out here in the Midwest, some in the East Coast, in California, and so forth. But the idea here is that with all this advanced sensing, we get a much better picture of what's going on in the grid in real time. So that might allow us to avoid, for example, cascading failures going forward if some kind of outage starts happening. Now, a challenge that's brought up by all this advanced sensing and reliance on advanced sensing is security. Okay, so there are two kinds of attacks that people think about when they think about security related to sensing. Okay, so the idea is that you use the sensor data to estimate the so-called state of the grid, which tells you a little bit about the phases of all the signals out there in the grid. And there are two ways you can attack that type of estimator system. One is a so-called data injection attack, where you where a hacker gets control of some of these PMUs and changes the values they send back to the operator, and then the operator gets an erroneous idea of what's going on in the grid. So the grid could be perfectly fine, but the operator gets the wrong idea about that, okay? And so maybe take some remedial action that then actually does something negative to the grid, brings it down, brings parts of it down or something like that. So it's called a data injection attack. Another type of attack is a physical injection attack, where the idea is, so in the first case, you want to change the state estimate without changing the state. That's a data injection attack. In a physical injection attack, you want to change the state of the grid by putting power in somewhere without changing state estimates. So you change actually what's happening in the grid without the operators knowing it. Okay, so then you could cause a lot of damage. And by the way, that could still be a cyber attack, because you could do that by hacking into a power plant and having it inject power, more power than it should, or something like that. Physical injection attacks, these are possible, okay? I don't know if they've happened in the grid, but if you may have read at some time in the past about the Stuxnet attack on the Iranian uranium enrichment plant, where the centrifuges were spinning out of control. So this was a physical attack, and the operators didn't know it. They were looking at their screens, and everything looked like it was okay. So that kind of attack has happened in another arena, and it could certainly happen in the power grid. Okay, so this is an important issue. Whenever you start adding more cyber infrastructure, you start adding more challenges to security. And these are two of them. Another aspect of advanced situational awareness is smart metering. So a smart meter, I don't know if you have smart meters in College Station. Does anybody have a smart meter? Yeah, okay, so Lud does, okay. So a smart meter is just so classically your meter is, once a month somebody comes out and reads your meter and you get a bill for that. So a smart meter is a meter that reports almost real-time power usage. And so maybe it's really every 15 minutes or so, but it's roughly real time. And the idea behind smart meter is that allows you to, 60 to 70% of Texas, okay, has smart meters. That allows the operator to do things like spot pricing. It also allows you as a consumer to maybe control your power usage more finely and so forth. So it has a lot of implications for efficiency of the grid, smart metering. On the other hand, I'm going to come back to that. So basically, one of the things smart metering might allows is so-called demand response, and I talked about that a little bit before. So the idea with demand response is to try to, is sort of, you probably heard the term smart homes, smart buildings, is to allow finer control of the energy use in a building in order to lower the peak demand, or to in some way other way to optimize power. This is called demand response. It's where the loads, that is us, get to have some say in how the energy is used in our house, rather than just having electrons pouring in to our house without having any really control over how that happens. Okay. So the idea of demand response, one of the most important things is load trimming. So you might have peak load here, 2 p.m., and with demand response, you might be able to lower the peak load by shifting something off at night, like your washer dryer or your clothes washer, your dishwasher or something like that. Loads like that might be shifted into the night. Your air conditioner might be cycled differently and something like that. The idea there is you can bring down peak demand, and also you can use electricity at night when it's cheaper. One of the issues, though, with smart metering is privacy. So this is not a real smart meter trace, but it looks a lot like a real one. It's a cleaner version of that. But basically, if you look at the trace of a smart meter, there are signatures for the various appliances and so forth in your house. So you can take a smart meter trace, and you can see what's happening inside the house from that smart meter trace. Okay, so there's a privacy issue associated with smart metering. That is, the power company can look at your smart meter trace and tell basically something about your lifestyle, okay? So, you know, this is an issue. This is just like Amazon challenges our privacy by using our private data. You know, your power company, although they don't do this today, they could learn what kind of consumer you are and sell that data to advertisers or what have you without our permission. So privacy issue, the same as the privacy issue on the internet. You got the privacy issue on the electricity grid if you have a smart meter. Another challenge is security. So another aspect of demand response is the introduction of so-called Internet of Things devices. So these are like Nest. If you have Nest in your home or something like that, you have device. You have your water heater, your refrigerator, your air conditioner are on the web, and you can control them with a web application from your phone or what have you. And it turns out that's also susceptible to security breach. So this is a study we did at Princeton, actually, where we looked at a situation where a botnet, so this is an application on a network, can go out and get control of IoT devices, Internet of Things devices, IoT devices like that, and if simultaneously turn them all on or all off, you can create a surge of power that could then cause cascading failure. Okay, and this again is not science fiction. There was such a botnet that went out and brought down the internet in Europe. Okay, a couple years ago, called the Mirai botnet. So this same kind of botnet could be used to go out and control IoT devices and cause cascading failures. It won't happen today because there's not enough of those devices out there, but when there are, there's going to be a security problem, basically, where some malicious actor could just bring down the grid, or at least parts of the grid, by going in and controlling these devices, usually which have very, very weak security, so they're not protected like your bank, okay? These are very insecure devices. So this is a problem. Another solution here is the use of high-voltage DC. So I mentioned at the beginning that there was this current war between Edison and Westinghouse about whether DC or AC was a better transmission medium for electricity. And AC won out mainly because it's easier to make high-voltage AC. But a lot of recent developments in power electronics have now made it easier to make high-voltage DC. And DC has some favorable properties relative to AC in terms of transmission. Once you get the voltage up there, DC is actually more efficient for transmission. You can use, first of all, smaller. You don't have leakages, so the time-varying signals cause a leakage of energy through radiation. You don't have that as much with DC. There are other aspects of transmission that are easier. You can use smaller conductors, which means you don't need as many pylons to carry the same amount of energy and so forth. So there are good reasons to use DC if you can get the voltages up, and now there's been developments that allow that to happen. So things like this allow the creation of grid scale, a grid power or transmission grid power at high voltage DC. Okay, so this is Germany and Switzerland, I don't know, but basically this is a grid scale power electronics. So power electronics used to be low voltage stuff, low power stuff. Now you can get power electronics that can put very high voltage DC out there. So then you can have these advantages of DC and transmission line, which was impossible back in Edison's day. So there already are high voltage DC transmission lines, and you probably see more of that. Also, a lot of loads are DC, so you don't have the inefficiencies of converting AC to DC that you have with current systems. So this is a more efficient way to deliver power in many cases. Another solution is microgrids. So what's a microgrid? Well, a microgrid, so we talked about the big grid. A microgrid is a smaller grid, maybe the size of a university campus or just a neighborhood. or even something smaller, but mainly about that size, where you have some generation, so maybe photovoltaic and wind, or maybe even smaller other kinds of generators. You have loads, okay? Loads are us, okay, or are things we use. And then these are all together in a smaller area, okay? And they interface with the main grid, but they may act autonomously at times. So the power that's generated in the microgrid is actually used in the microgrid. It never goes back into the main grid, and these loads maybe never need to draw energy from the main grid. So this is a more efficient system. There are fewer losses in transmission and so forth, okay? So this is and also it's more secure because it's walled off, can be walled off from the main grid and what have you, okay? So this is a new trend. The military has a lot of these. This is a sort of where a lot of these microgrids were developed originally. But this is a much more efficient way in many ways and more reliable way to provide energy over, say, a neighborhood. And this is a trend that's happening today. Okay, so I'm about out of time here, so let me wrap up. So I'm going to summarize briefly, and then I want to talk about some of the main research and development issues that are out there. So what have I talked about? First of all, what is smart grid? Well, it's a set of potentially disruptive technologies to produce greater efficiency, reliability, and security in the grid. I mentioned some examples, so the integration of renewables, grid-scale storage, advanced power electronics, I think should be an and there, advanced measurement, analytics, and control for greater situational awareness, microgrids, I mentioned just briefly. On the other hand, you know, there's a lot going on. This is a big, very rapid area, very rapid technology development and research as well. And some of the major needs here are the ones that are listed here. This is an incomplete list, but these are some of the more important ones. The first one is storage technologies. If we could store electricity, we'd be a lot better off in many, many ways. If we could store electricity at large scale, we'd be a lot better off in many ways. Power electronics is there's continually a lot of research going on there. Texas A&M is one of the leaders in this field. That's for conversion, AC-DC conversion, control, and so forth. Advanced data analytics, so machine learning is another big aspect here. Once you start generating a lot of data from all these phasor measurement units and smart meters and all that sort of stuff, you've got a big data problem, and then you need to glean that data, mine it for information. That's a data analytics problem, so machine learning and AI and things like that come into play there. Also, once you have a generation distributed out in the grid and where the generation is owned by individuals, then you start having another kind of energy market from what we have traditionally. That is, we used to have consumers. Now we sort of have prosumers, so producers and consumers. So if I have a solar array on my house, I turn from a consumer of electricity into sometimes a producer of electricity. And so that creates a market. So there can be trading between prosumers, trading from the prosumer to the grid, and so forth and so on. So there's a whole economic aspect of this problem that comes up. You need platforms for that. You need to understand how the behavior of that. There's a role for game theory there and behavioral economics and so forth. Security at all levels. I mentioned security several times. Whenever you make the grid more smarter, you have to worry more about security, because that means if you connect the grid to the internet, then you've got a big security problem that has to be addressed, just like anything else. And then privacy is another issue I mentioned briefly, but I think also it's an important aspect. Just like when the internet was developed, a lot of things happened to breach people's privacy, and now we're learning a lot about that we didn't know. And the same thing could happen with the grid. Once information is being collected on consumers, privacy gets to be a big issue. So with that, I'm done, and I'm happy to take questions if there's time, Tom. So thank you. So it was either crystal clear or completely opaque.
I'm sure there's something. Anybody have any questions?
people want to go to the reception. There's one up there.
Thank you for the very important lecture. I wanted to have your opinion about how do you see general purpose AI different from AI machine learning for critical infrastructure systems?
How the general purpose differs, you mean?
Right.
Yes.
Then the question is, should we just kind of apply and adapt those to some
That's a good.
Or is there any unique aspect of this grid and other grid infrastructure systems that make the AI not as just generally plug and play?
Yeah. I think the more generic kind of AI has a role, just data mining and those kind of things. Reinforcement learning, which is one of the things for control. But here, one of the things about the grid is the topology of the grid is a very complicated, connected network, very big. And I don't know any other, and so one of the problems you might want to use AI is to try to make inferences about outage, if lines go down, which lines have gone down. Okay, that's a problem. So topology changes in the grid are a problem that you could address using some types of machine learning or algorithms for detecting topology changes. And I don't know of any other application where you have such a complicated topology to make inferences about. So I think that's a unique problem for the electricity grid. There may be some other applications in other fields, biology, say, or something, but I think that's kind of a unique problem, so topology identification kinds of problems. And there is some work on using machine learning for that kind of problem. There may be others too, but that's an example. So it's a good question.
I want to thank you very much for talking about the emphasis on privacy and security and thinking about that in a proactive manner. I'm just wondering, how much have you been talking with the utilities about different business models? Because I know in a couple of states you've seen active pushback from utilities about microgrids, about saying if you're generating your own power, how are we going to make any money?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a good question. So, I mean, in fact, that's a big issue, right, in the grid I mentioned earlier, because the electricity utilities are regulated, right, very heavily. And the way they make money is mostly by capital return on capital, right? And where does that return come from? Well, it comes from selling electricity, right? So it is an issue, but in my utility is PSE&G, Public Service Electric and Gas. And we talked to them a little bit about demand-side management, which is really, in some ways, they're working against their own interest to get people to use less electricity. But here's something they told me, which I thought was interesting, is they had bought the power company that serves Long Island, and they were going to have to put in a new transmission line if they couldn't reduce the consumption. So they were interested in it because they didn't want to make that big capital investment. So I think there is common ground, where they are. And in fact, since it's regulatory, the regulatory agencies could always apply that, as one of the targets they should hit would be increased efficiency and so forth. I mean, I look in my neighborhood, and power and solar arrays have appeared, small ones have appeared all along the distribution lines, and I'm sure the power company put them there, and I don't know why. I don't know if they were induced to do that or they did it out of the good of their own hearts, but there do seem to be some incentives pushing toward that kind of thing. And I think in the end, there are businesses and they have to think about that, but they could, if advantages come to them from having a more efficient system or what have you, I think they're going to, they'll respond. So, and I have talked to utilities about that. So.
Howdy. Thanks for a great talk and timely talk. You put up some energy storage devices on the one slide, and I was thinking one of the ones I look into is compressed air energy storage. There's a
There's
a couple in Iowa. I think there's one in Mobile, Alabama.
Yep.
The Navy does some research in underwater balloons and that type of thing. How do you see the role of that going forward?
Specifically of
compressed air.
Well, it's a little bit like pumped hydro, right? I think it's the thing about it is, I guess all these things store energy well. It's a question of the economics, right? And I don't know the economics of compressed air, but you know, if they built plants, I assume they're experimental. I mean, if they built, I'm sure they're experimental at this time. I don't know if they are they sort of grid scale. Yeah. So, yeah, but I mean, I think all these, you know, right now we don't really know what the answer is going to be. So I think we have to try all these kind of things. I mean, electronics could be part of the solution. In fact, all these things may be part of the solution. It may be have to have multiple technologies.
Yes, so I think a very important aspect you took up is the clean, how clean electricity is. Because, and you mentioned that the reduction of asthma, for instance, but it's also cancer with the pollutants which come from combustion car. So therefore you feel a bit sad when you are in Texas and see all these big cars emitting all this combustion. So we really need to go into better technologies like electric cars or other type of to avoid that. But would you be able to produce all the electricity to replace all the cars which are run on petrol these days?
Well, again, it's a question of economics, right? I mean, I think now you can see that there's a trend toward renewables, right? There are challenges, you know, the stability of the grid and so forth. And storage being one of the big ones. So, if it sort of goes together, if you have enough electric cars, maybe you can create a storage at a scale that would be useful. I did see an article, I didn't put it in here, I had it actually in here before, but it's actually something in one of the Texas publications about one of the issues with electric vehicles is that the mobility, which you don't have, so you have mobile loads, so you don't have mobility now, so things are where they are. These lights are going to stay right here, right? Whereas with cars, you have mobile, the demand moves physically, right? So that's a whole nother issue that can be, it could cause issues with distribution and so forth. So, I think if we see more and more electric vehicles, we're going to see maybe some solutions come out of it, but we're also going to see some problems, you know, like that. So everybody drives over to College Station in their electric car, the load's going to go way up the next morning when they charge up to go home. So these are kind of issues that we don't have today in electric grids. So.
Okay, we have time for one last question.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to turn the last question around. You pointed out early in the talk that our usage is stagnating. The big utilities are experiencing pressure from the prosumers, as you've described them, essentially other competing generators. So, if I were the head of a utility, the one big market out there is the 25% of our energy supply that goes to transportation. The one thing that actually does feed into the traditional utility model, where its return on the capital investment is new demand, and the place it's about the only place I can see it coming from is on the transportation side.
Yeah, that was not a question. I guess it was a comment, but I agree. It's a good point. So, okay. Thank you.
Thank you for the talk. I have a little memento for you. Yeah, no, it's not maroon. It is clear, and this is a memento of the talk.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for the wonderful presentation. And for all of you, we have a wonderful reception right next door, and so please make your way to the reception, and thank you very much for coming. Yes, sir. There is a box right here.
Oh, good.
And
hey, Tom, thanks for the intro. Appreciate it.
I don't know how loaded you are going back. We can.